How is everybody today? You're enjoying this beautiful warm weather we're having? Kind of hot out there, isn't it? Well, before we jump into God's Word today, I just want to take a few moments to say some thank yous. As Don mentioned at the first of the service, this week has been an incredible week. Thursday and Friday when we hosted the Leadership Summit here, along about halfway through the morning on Thursday morning, actually one of the first speakers talked about what they called productive paranoia, which means that, you know, you're kind of on the alert because you want to be prepared in case anything goes wrong. And I recognized that I was going through productive paranoia because I kept thinking things cannot possibly go this well all the time. Sooner or later, something's got to go wrong because everything was running so smoothly. And so I was kind of like on heightened alert, and I was going around looking for things and thinking, surely, you know, let's be prepared. And you know what? Nothing ever went wrong. Our team of volunteers was stellar. Over 60 people from our church. Many of you volunteer and help. Actually, I'm wearing the little volunteer outfit today, the shirt, and to honor all the volunteers. Not because I just love this shirt and think I look good in it, even if that's true, but I actually chose to wear it today simply to honor all of you that wore this shirt or one like it and served and served and served. When we decided to host the summit, we start crunching the numbers. We've been attending out at Cornerstone, and it's easy for us to say, well, Cornerstone's this huge place. They've got all these people. It's easy for them to do it. And we, you know, in December of last year when we made the commitment to be the host, and you're looking down the pike and go, okay, you know, it's going to be a big deal. But, you know, God just raised up people. One of the things that we assembled to start with was what they call a team of a leadership team to oversee this, and there were six roles. One of them was the senior pastor role, obviously, and so this is one of those great events where the senior pastor gets to look good because his people are really good. And I wish I could take credit for everything that happened this past week, but I can't. But I want to give a special shout out to the five other team leads that coordinated everything that went on. Martha Wenzel was our resource director, and she and her team handled all the resources that were available for people in our bookstore area out here. She did a super job of doing that. James Whittle, who's actually took a vacation after this was over and is not here today, was our technical director, and with help with Danny Mann, they did all the technical stuff and with his team, which is amazing. They did a great job. Brenda Elzer was our producer. And I didn't know if I could get up here this morning without Brenda talking in my ear, because she was talking in my ear for 2 days, because it's her job during the thing to make sure we were in sync with what was happening around the country with the satellite feed. So when it was my turn to do announcements, she was counting down the seconds in my ear to make sure I didn't run long and we were in sync with everything. And she was coordinating that and did a great job. There are two jobs that were behind the scenes in many ways, but they were probably the two most strategic jobs. In fact, the Willow Creek people told us these are their two most strategic jobs to make this thing work. One's the promotional strategist, who for months has been working with a team to get the word out in both locally in our own church and all around the East Bay to help people know about this. And Kevin Sousa was our promotional strategist, did a super job getting the word out and coordinating all the build-up, the registrations, and making sure people got here. And then finally, Chris Jarvis was what was called the on-site event manager, which is a fancy title for you're in charge of making everything work when it gets down to conference time. And she led a team of volunteers that just made everything work so incredibly smoothly. So these were the lead people, and they had built teams of, well, many of you were on those teams, that, and I stood back and this thing was all over and just marveled at the amazing job that VCC did in putting on this a two-day event. The cool thing about it to me was when I had pastors, senior pastors, lead pastors from other churches coming up to me, thanking me and telling me how they felt welcomed, how things had run smoothly, what an incredible host we were, and went on and on and on. And I just, one of those proud papa moments where you're saying, it's just great to be a part of this team. And so if you were part of that, all of you that were a part of making that happen, for those that you were able to attend and learn from the speakers and this has been a great, great time for us. And whenever you launch into something big for the first time, you don't know how it's going to come out. And I can look back and say it was the right choice, the God-led choice for us to be the host. Our people stepped up, and I'm just so proud to be your pastor and to lead this great group of folks. So once again, just a great, great thank you to all who helped make that possible. So one of the things we began to think about even long before was, okay, so we do this, and what's next? What do we do out of that? And one of the things we're trying to do is to build, as we go forward, to try to take some of the things that God is doing, both in our preparation for and participation in the Leadership Summit, and some of the other streams that God's been working in our lives. This summer, we've spent the summer talking about how do we walk closer with the Lord? What are the spiritual practices and disciplines and of our lives that can draw us deeper into discipleship, deeper into conformity in the image of Christ? And how do these streams come together? So what we're going to be doing over the next few weeks and a couple of months is to actually sort of bring these two streams together. This Sunday and next, we're just going to take a look at a story in the scriptures that illustrates some leadership principles and some formation principles that I want to just sort of remind us of some things. And then on August 26th, when we jump into the beginning of our fall schedule, when all the ministries start back up, first day for children's new year and student ministries new year, and we kind of crank up our church calendar, we're going to take a look over a series of weeks at Paul's instruction to Timothy, a young leader, from an older mentor leader, and ask some questions about what does it mean for us to become the kind of people that can make a difference in God's kingdom, to learn what does it mean to grow as a leader and even be formed by God into the kind of person who can be an effective leader in God's kingdom. So that's where we're going to be headed over the next few weeks. And it's a pretty strategic time because a lot of amazing things are going to happen. Important events are happening between now and, say, Thanksgiving of this year. Do you realize how many big, big things are going to happen between now and Thanksgiving? And not just the start of football season, not just the World Series, as important as those things are. But there are a number of events that are going to happen nationally and locally in that time. By the time we get to Thanksgiving, we will have had another presidential election. Right? But perhaps even more importantly, by then there'll be a Chick-fil-A open in North San Jose and in Walnut Creek, and that will really enhance my life experience a lot. So lots of things changing, happening all the time. But I'm, you know, like, I don't know about you, but I'm already a little bit tired of the election, and we haven't even had the conventions yet. I'm not a big fan of the U.S. election system anymore because I don't like the way that everybody just tears everybody else down, and I don't think it's a productive way to make a choice. But nonetheless, we're in that season, and we're going to be under an unceasing barrage of information and disinformation about candidates and policies and who's going to save our country and who's going to ruin it. And that's, we're going to hear that nonstop between now and November, and then this election is going to take place. And what we're going to do is elect a person that we have assigned the title to the leader of the free world. We Americans, in our, let's be honest, in our arrogance, in our hubris, like to say, for all of you who non-Americans, I want to, on behalf of all of us, confess to you that we have a way of placing on ourselves these grandiose titles, and the President of the United States has been referred to for a long time as the leader of the free world. Now, I first heard that growing up, and it was kind of in contradistinction to the Soviet Empire, and then there's the Western, and the U.S. was sort of at the forefront of that, and so that kind of, that title sort of grew to stick, and now we talk about that, the president as, the quote, the leader of the free world. And there's an interesting thing about that, because it reinforces for us a basic way that we think about leadership. And while there is certain a measure of truth of this, sort of our reflexive idea about leadership is a position that a person has. That leadership is about the position you have. In other words, I am a leader of this church because I hold the position or title of senior pastor. The president is the leader. I mean, he's the leader because he's the president. Now, there's a certain amount of truth that offices and positions and titles carry some weight and responsibility in those jobs or those positions. But one of the mistakes that we make in our thinking about leadership is if we allow that to be the dominant idea about what leadership is all about, someone that holds a position. And in fact, when we look in the scriptures, position is not the central and most important thing about leadership. And over the next few weeks, we hope to at least unpack that idea a little bit. So here's where we're going to start. We're going to look at an Old Testament character over the next 2 weeks It's very, if you've been around the Bible or grew up around church, and you've heard this story many, many times. And even if you haven't ever gone to church very much or heard the Bible, you may have heard the Broadway version of this at least talked about, and that's the life of this man, Joseph. I tried to get Don to bring Donny Osmond to come in and sing the Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, since he did that on Broadway for years, but we couldn't get him to come. I asked maybe Don to dress up like Donny Osmond and sing those songs, but he declined on that as well. But Joseph in the Old Testament, and the quote, the story of Joseph and the coat of many colors, is a story, an idea, at least something that people have heard or hear often. But I want to explore the story a little bit from the person Joseph and how God prepared him as a leader. So we're going to talk about this life of a leader, and the first this Sunday we're going to talk about preparation of that leader. And what we're going to do is just look at the Joseph story, half of it today and half of it next Sunday, to see what we can learn about being a leader. Now, if you got a Bible, you want to turn to Genesis chapter 37. And from chapters 37 to 41, it begins on page 60 of your pew Bibles. If you want to grab one of those, you can put your finger there. We're going to be in the chapters Genesis 37 through 41 today and pick up the end of the story next week. Now, beginning in chapter 37, in verse 2, here's what the text says. I'm going to read beginning just the opening of the story from verse 2 down to verse 11. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. Some translations say a coat of many colors, a richly ornamented robe for him. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. And Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brother said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. And then he had another dream. And he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And when he told his father, as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Let's stop there for a moment and go back and just look quick. I'm going to remind you what verse 3 says. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he'd been born to his old age, and he made him a richly ornamented robe for him. Here's the story. Israel is Jacob. In the Old Testament, when God began his program of rescuing human beings and his program of establishing a nation, a conduit, a blessing to the world, he chose Abraham. Abraham had a son, Isaac. Isaac had a son, Jacob. Jacob now is that third generation of this lineage that God now is beginning to use to build the nation of Israel eventually, in which the conduit of God's blessing and work to this world would come. And so in that, Jacob then has these 12 sons. The story is complicated. Jacob ended up with two wives and two, they had handmaidens, and he had actually had children by four different women. We won't explore all that this morning, but it was a complicated family situation nonetheless. Joseph is son number 11, or he's son, and to them, there's these 10 brothers, and it's him and his younger brother Benjamin were born of Jacob's favorite wife and had favor with him. And Joseph was obviously the favorite. When he was 17 years old, so by the way, a 17-year-old in that society is not like a 17-year-old in our society. We hope that our 17-year-olds are remotely thinking about one day possibly growing up, right? And we have sort of our extended adolescent years that we have now, and the way our society is constructed, a 17-year-old is looked upon as one hopefully one day will grow into an adult. A 17-year-old in that culture would have already have begun to assume adult responsibilities. He was definitely one of the younger brothers, and these older brothers already didn't like him. And then the father obviously Jacob loves, Israel loves his son Joseph. He gives him this coat, whether it's a many colors or ornamental robe, whatever. He places this robe on them, and all of a sudden his brothers hate him all the more. Now, this is symbolic because of some important thing in the way the families were constructed. It was normally the oldest son, the firstborn, who would be the rightful heir of the lineage and all of the blessings and would be at the top of the heap. That's a guy named Reuben. He's going to come up in a moment. But instead of the favor being shown to Reuben, this placing of the robe on Joseph, who's the firstborn of the favorite wife, but not the firstborn of the actual of all his sons, basically Jacob is saying to all of them, I'm choosing Joseph as the one that bestow my blessing on, not the one who was the normal firstborn, Reuben. So already there's this conflict going. Jacob has been showing this favor to him and has now demonstrated this, almost anointing him as his rightful heir and successor in front of his older brothers, and this has just driven the wedge deeper, driven it deeper. Now, there's a lot of speculation about Joseph at this time. Is he really as brash and cocky and arrogant, going around saying, hey, here, I got a dream and you guys are going to do this? It's hard to say. There's a lot of difference of opinion. At the very least, Joseph is not at all shy about telling what has been going on in his dream life, these dreams that depict the others bowing down for him. And all of this, whether he's deliberately being arrogant in their face or just simply reporting that which he's experiencing, regardless of which is true, the wedge has been drawn deeper and deeper. So as the story goes, one time his older brothers are out with their flocks. Jacob sends Joseph out to look for them. And lo and behold, they see him coming from afar. And over in verses 21 and 22, there's a plot going on. The brothers now have a plot going on. Let's just get rid of this guy, Joseph, once and for all. Let's kill him and tell dad he was eaten by a lion or something, and we'll be off the hook. We'll be done with this guy forever. Reuben jumps in at verse 21. When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. Let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. Throw him into a cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. Now, here's what, the brothers are plotting to kill him and be done with him. Reuben said, whoa, let's think this through. Now, lest we think Reuben is acting simply out of care for Joseph, he's not. Notice the last line there. Here's Reuben's got another plan. Let's pretend that Joseph's been in danger. We'll throw him in a pit. I will rescue him and take him back to the father. Reuben is the rightful firstborn. He's trying to get back on his dad's good side. He's hoping that if he's the hero of the story here, maybe dad will put the blessing on him like he thinks is his. Well, as the story goes on, Reuben is apart from them for a while, and then the brothers decide to throw him in a pit. They throw him in the pit. Reuben goes away for a moment, and they see some merchants coming that are headed down to Egypt. In verse 28, so when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. So Joseph gets sold by his brothers to slave traders who are now going to take him down to Egypt. Reuben comes back after this, and he's just distraught. What have you done? Now, basically, my plot's foiled. I wanted to be able to be the hero, and now you've taken that away. I don't get to be the hero and save my little brother and take him home and make my dad all happy. So that plot is destroyed too. Well, they take his coat, that ornamental coat, they dip it in animal's blood, they take it home to show it to Jacob, and of course, Jacob is heartbroken. He's sure now that Joseph, his favorite son, is dead. And just stop for a moment and think, though, about Joseph. Joseph eventually is going to be, God's going to raise him up in some strategic and amazing ways and use him. And I think about how the formation of Joseph's character as a leader, as the story unfolds. Joseph, as a young man, as a 17-year-old, has experienced his father's favor. He's had the robe put on him. He's already recognized that his brothers are jealous, but he's certainly seen the favor of his father. He's had these two dreams, and he actually believes, Joseph does, that there's a future for him where he will have a prominent role, at least in which his other brothers and even his mother and father are going in some way pay homage to him as a leader. And as a 17-year-old, that's a lot to process. that one day I'm going to be great. And one day I'm going to have all these responsibilities. And so often we like to draw the shortest line possible from point A to point B. We want that to go, okay, God showed me I'm going to be a leader. Let's get to it. Let's get to it. And here, but in Joseph's life, it's radically different. God takes him on this circuitous route. Can you imagine what's going through David's mind when he's at the bottom of that well? Excuse me, Joseph, when he's at the bottom of that well. His brothers have now thrown him down there. He probably can hear them plotting when the Midianite slave traders come through. And now he's being sold. At what point in all this is Joseph going, whoa, what about the bow down before me stuff? What about the leader stuff? And there's something incredibly important in here. If we conceive of leadership as about positions attained, if that's the way we think about leadership, where am I positionally, we're going to miss some of the most important things about it. You see, we never have as much control over our circumstances as we think we do. We don't. We exert enormous amounts of energy trying to engineer circumstances many times. And that we like to hold on to that idea that we can chart a path, even when we feel a calling towards something, or a gifting towards something, or a burden for something. It's not wrong to take steps toward fulfillment of that calling and that burden, whatever, but we delude ourselves if we think we have control over that process. We often have no control at all. And listen carefully, how we respond to the stuff of life speaks volumes about our character and our ability to lead. Now, Joseph's at the bottom of this well, and then he's sold into slavery. And through all of this, what is going on with Joseph internally? And the thing is, we don't know. The story doesn't tell us what's going on in Joseph's heart and mind. All we have is the depiction of the outcome of that process. But here's one of the things that's so important about the story and about the whole biblical concept of what it means to be a leader is that it starts with the formation of who we are as people. It's not about position, it's about the kind of person we are. For at its core, leadership is about influence. And what kind of influence are we going to be in helping people toward that which matters? In the case of Joseph, God's preparation for whatever he's going to do with Joseph's life ends him up in the bottom of a well as the treacherous act of his brothers, and then finally sold into slavery. And through all of that, Joseph has to make choices. Am I going to trust God? Am I going to be bitter? Am I going to be angry? What am I going to do? Am I going to despair? How am I going to respond to all these circumstances in life over which I have absolutely no control at all? And so for you and for me, as we are walking day by day in faith, it's not wrong to try to plan our lives. It's not wrong to try to have goals and aspirations. None of that is evil or wrong, but we must understand that we can't control things, that life happens. And as we said even last week, life itself is one of the very, very most essential, important arenas where God forms us more and more into the image of Christ. So he allows Joseph to go into this incredibly unwarranted plot of his brothers and end up being sold into slavery. So the formation of the leader's character is foundational to his ability to lead. Now, we want to go on in the story. We're going to fast forward over into chapter 39. Now, not only was it seems like Joseph has trusted God. He's ended up in a place not of his choosing, circumstances beyond his control, and yet he's trusting God. Let's see what happens. Chapter 39, beginning in verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's, taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. So where does Joseph end up? He ends up the personal house slave of a military leader in Pharaoh's command, this man named Potiphar. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. And Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So he left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Now, what does he say? Joseph, we found out, we fast forward, he's down in Egypt, he's been sold into the ownership of this man, Potiphar. And what do we learn about Joseph at this point? He's not bitter. He's not angry. He's not rebellious. He's not sulking away in Potiphar's house, doing the least amount that he could do and hoping he can stay out of trouble or whatever else. He simply goes about the business and the situation he is to the best of his ability, trusting God. And what does God do? He shows him favor. To the point that Potiphar even sees this. This pagan Egyptian leader himself looks at this guy and says, wow, there's something special about this guy, Joseph. And he starts giving him more and more responsibility and more and more responsibility. And Joseph takes that and he does a great job. Now, the story takes a weird and crazy turn. Put yourself in Joseph's. I've trusted God, I'm in slavery, I don't know what I'm, but I'm gonna do the best I can and trust God, and God's starting to give me blessing and favor in Potiphar's eyes, and now I'm in charge of his whole household, and enter Potiphar's wife. Potiphar's wife is a bored rich lady. She has her own television show, Real Housewives of Egypt. She's one of the cast of that show. And she obviously is bored with her life and with her husband or whatever, and she spots this handsome, good-looking Egyptian slave who's now working for her husband and is running their household, and she has eyes for him, and she tries to seduce him. And Joseph resists, and she tries again, and he resists. He's very honorable. He does not demean her. He simply says, I can't do this. I work for your husband. I can't do this before God. And he continues to refuse to the point that she gets more and more aggressive. And finally, when he refuses, he flees and his cloak falls off. And she decides, she's so angry, she claims that he assaults her. She tells everybody and eventually tells her husband that Joseph has assaulted her. Now over in verse 19, Potiphar's reaction in verse 39:19, when his master heard the story that his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me, he burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. While Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. And the warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Now, once again, put yourself in Joseph's place. He's done everything he could, kept his attitude right, served right. Now where does he end up? He ends up in jail, falsely accused of assaulting this woman. So what does he do when he gets to jail? What he's always done. He just trusts God and obeys God and has a great attitude and just says, you know, I don't, and lives his life. And what happens? God's favor is upon him. The warden understands what a great guy is and he's in charge of most of the jail now. Well, as it turns out, there are two other guys that Pharaoh had sent his cupbearer and his baker to prison for something that they did, got him angry. End up in jail with Joseph, and they have some dreams. They don't know how to interpret the dreams and what's going on with them. Joseph, God gives him the interpretation of their dreams. Turns out the baker is going to be judged and hanged, and the cupbearer is going to be restored to his place. And so what does Joseph say simply to the cupbearer? When you get back up there with Pharaoh, would you just maybe put in a good word for me? And in verse chapter 40, verse 23, if I were Joseph, this would be it. Here is the straw that breaks the Egyptian camel's back. 23, the cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. At what point is you, Joseph, you just say, I'm done. God, I don't know where you are. This is all great that I get to be a big wig in the jail, but you know, I am in jail. I do this favor for the cupbearer, and he's got the Pharaoh's right, you know, he's right there and has the ear of Pharaoh, and he forgot him. forgot him. For 2 whole years, Joseph stays in jail. Cupbearer forgets him. And Joseph's still faithful. Turns out Pharaoh has a dream, 2 dreams. And the cupbearer goes, oh, I remember that guy back in jail who helped me out. There's this guy. And then over in verse 15 and 16 of chapter 41, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream and no one can interpret it, but I have heard it said said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. What does Joseph say? I can't do it, but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. So Joseph interprets the dreams that predicts famine, of 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. He gives Pharaoh advice on how to handle that and what the fulfillment of that dream. And over in verse 39 and 40, Joseph says, you probably ought to get somebody that's pretty smart to be in charge of this. And Pharaoh in verse 39 says this, and Pharaoh says to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all of my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. The plenty comes, the famine comes, and then at the end of chapter 41, verse 56, when the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt, and all the countries came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the world. So here's the cycle. Finally, by the way, 13 years have transpired from where this story started. Joseph is now 30 years old, and he's been in slavery. He's been falsely accused and thrown in prison. And finally, after all of this, he ends up in an actual position of leadership, of renown. But the pathway there was one that he would have never chosen. See, here's the problem. Often we believe that if we respond correctly to the circumstances of our lives, then God will, quote, bless us and improve those circumstances. Joseph's story says, not always, at least not in the way you might think. That's why it is dangerous. There's theology that runs around in the Christian world, particularly in our country here, that says, oh, if you will just do this for God, God's going to pour out, you're going to get, you know, healthy, wealthy, whatever. And there's this line toward blessing. If you'll just do the right thing now and the right thing, you're going to head this path toward blessing. Now, sometimes God does that. But the story of Joseph reminds us that the route that God may take us on, it's not a straight line. And what we call blessing may not be God's blessing at all. He may have a different path for us. And his blessing may be quite different. And so here we find Joseph finally, after all of this, 13 years of all this calamity, and he's finally in this position of leadership. And the words of Jesus come running through this story. The one that wants to find his life has to be willing to lose it. And Joseph never turned bitter. He never turned angry. Even when the cupbearer forgets him, he's just faithful. He's just faithful. And finally, God's plan begins to be worked out, and he finds himself in a position. Now, if you'd have gone back, let's rewind to chapter 37, Joseph the 17-year-old with his dreams. If you'd have walked up, man on the street interview with Joseph, what do you think these dreams mean? 2 things I think Joseph could never have described. That the end game, whether he was going to be the second most powerful man in the entire Egyptian empire, and that the route to get there would have taken him to slavery and to jail. None of that would have been on Joseph's radar at all. What was on Joseph's radar is, I serve and love God. I will trust him on the course that he takes him. I'll let him form me. And even when his faith is tested, it becomes the way that God forms us into the kind of people that can have impact in this world for him, is that he causes us to trust him every step of the way. And sometimes those circumstances are inscrutable. Sometimes we have no answer to the question, why? In reality, our response to our circumstances makes us stronger and more likely to trust God in whatever lies before us, whether good or bad. And here's what the end of this part of the story. We'll pick it up next week and get even deeper into the outcomes and what God is doing, but let's taste that a little bit. Because what's happening here, and we have to all remember, every one of us Our characters, our story is a subplot to a greater story. And the greater story is God's story. God's story of the gospel. God's story of the rescue of humankind. God's story of grace and mercy and forgiveness and restoration and rebuilding a people and forgiveness and eternal life and all the things that God's doing. Our lives are subplots in that grand plot. And so Joseph's path in this takes him to a place, as we'll see next week, where he is a significant hinge figure in what God is doing. And you and I are called upon, one, to embrace the glory, the beauty, the wonder, the grandeur of God's great story, and then see, even when we can't see all of the big picture, God's faithfulness, his calling to us to be faithful day by day, step by step. So as men and women, boys and girls, who are going to be followers of Jesus, what God calls us to first and foremost is to trust him. It's not about reorienting our circumstances toward what we think we deserve or what would even be the best path for us to serve God. You ever thought that way? I do all the time. God, if you would just let me win the lottery, I would give it all the way to missionaries. You know, we are tempted to think crazy thoughts like, and yet God just says, trust me. I'm forming your character, I'm testing your faith, and I've got a bigger picture here. I want you just to walk with me, trust with me. Now, that doesn't answer all the mysteries of life. I bet if we one day when we're in heaven and we get to talk with Joseph, he's still gonna have a hard time going about the bottom of that well. He's gonna have a hard time about that jail thing. There are gonna be moments of, yeah, I had no idea what was going on. I just knew I had to trust God in that. And that's what God calls us. So whatever you're facing, we're a chance to yield yourself to the living God, to be a part of his grand story, to see how he's going to form you and test you and give you that opportunity. It doesn't matter what position you have. It matters that you have here's the difference in the way we can think about leadership in the right way. Leadership is not a position you hold. It's having the kind of life that others should follow. That's what leadership is. That's what real biblical spiritual leadership influence is about. It's not about holding a position. It's about having the kind of life where God is present, acting, where others can follow and see God through it. That's what he's calling us. I ask you just to bow your head as we close and pray. Lord, thank you for this grand truth. For each man and woman, child, and this auditorium, we ask that you would give us a heart of trust in you. And that trust is not only that you're going to work out your purposes, but you're going to work out your purposes for us. You're going to keep working in us, changing us. Help us not to be addicted to circumstances and trying to figure them out or change them as much as we are to releasing ourselves to be formed, changed, grown, developed, and our faith in the midst of those circumstances. I thank you that you're a God that rescues, that uses the stuff of this life to change and form us. And that as we yield our lives, you never ever let go. You never let go of Joseph's life, even in that dungeon, even in that well, you never let go. And we can trust you to form us, grow us, and use us to your glory. May we be inspired by what you did in Joseph's life to be a part of that grand story and to yield our lives to you. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.